Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Genevieve Kosky, here again with
Keith Phipps,
Scott Tobias,
Tasha Robinson.
After deconstructing the comic brilliance of This Is Spinal Tap in the first half of this episode, today we're bringing in the new pop star, Never Stop, Never Stopping, a direct descendant of Spinal Tap with all the timely hallmarks of a 2016 comedy. Written by musical comedy trio The Lonely Island, a.k.a. Andy Samberg, Yorma Taccone, and Akiva Schaffer, and co-directed by Taccone and Schaffer, Popstar is a similarly collaborative, music-laced effort from a group of simpatico comic minds. While the members of The Lonely Island have taken on film projects together and separately before, most notably the nascent cult films Hot Rod and MacGruber, Popstar is the purest distillation of the formula that's made The Lonely Island the biggest thing in music parody this side of Weird Al Yankovic. Take one part pop-rap braggadocio, add two parts mundane absurdity, and multiply all that by monster hooks sung by big-name music stars. Popstar then cannily applies this formula to the recent strain of MTV-produced concert doc feature films, specifically Justin Bieber, Never Say Never, for a modern update of the mockumentary mold set by This Is Spinal Tap. The pop star of the film's title is Samberg's Connor for Real, a loose amalgam of Justin's Bieber and Timberlake, Kanye West, and Michael Jackson in his prime. Connor made his name as part of the Style Boys, a Beastie Boys-esque rap group formed with his childhood friends Owen and Lawrence, played by Taccone and Schaffer. But Connor broke off on his own when megastardom beckoned. Popstar introduces us to Connor at the height of his powers, on the brink of his sophomore album's release and its attendant world tour. Anyone who's seen Spinal Tap should be able to guess where things go from there.
Okay, where to start? Ever since I was born, I loved music. As soon as I could, I started a band.
Right away, we knew he was something special.
Immediately, I said, man, this guy right here, he's gonna make it big.
Connor for Real is actually saving the record industry.
Everybody's just waiting to see, like, what he does next.
Connor's hot.
You tell me you didn't see him and say, yo, he's the star.
All right, so Scott and Tasha, I saw Popstar with you, so I have a pretty good idea of where you guys stand, but Keith saw it separately from us, so I want to start with him. What did you think of Popstar?
I laughed and laughed and laughed. Yeah, no, I came in expecting to see a pretty funny movie, and I was I exceeded my expectations. It was a very smart, you know, send up of what's going on in music docs now, just in the way, much the way this Spinal Tap was for 1982, and those guys are just super winning. Watching it, I knew I was watching a film I'd be watching many times in the future, I think.
Yeah, I've already seen it a second time.
But, you know, America is going to hold off on
yeah,
it for now,
right?
And then catch it later, as they do with every single one of these types of movies.
We talked about it coming out of the film, Scott, and I said that I thought this would be the one to kind of break the mold of these guys' movies and be a hit, but I was clearly very, very wrong, and I don't understand why that is.
Maybe, well, according to, you know, business news that I've read about the film.
According to business.
It was like Universal kind of like planned it this way. It was kind of like, the Pee Wee Herman thing. I meant to do that. Where they were going to lightly promote it and not invest a lot of money both in the production of the film and the marketing of the film theatrically in the hope and expectation that the film would collect on the back end, as it kind of found its a certain cult appreciation, which I think it will find, just based on the fact that we all enjoy it, and since we enjoy it, it's going to stand the test of time.
Yes.
we're
personally ordering everybody to go watch it.
Yeah.
So I mean, we're the beginning of the snowball.
We're
the grit in the oyster that's going to become the pearl.
If you don't like Popstar, we can't be friends.
No, we can't. And I appreciated that it was just time to make this movie for the Lonely Island, to make an actual straight up Lonely Island movie, you know, and give it everything that they have, because they've been together since 2001, I think, as a performing troupe. They've had what, three albums before?
Four.
This will be their fourth. They've had many, you know, SNL digital shorts that have gone viral, and it was just time to do it, and they did it. And they did it right. I think it's a really funny movie that expands on what they do without seeming too strained or testing our patience. I mean, I know that's always the test with these things. When you have a sketch comedy troupe trying to make a movie, it's always like, well, will this one joke? Can you stretch the joke? Can that work? And it didn't work.
Especially something that Saturday Night Live derived.
Or musical, or something like, you look at the Tenacious D movie, for example, which has an unbelievably brilliant opening, and then it just can't follow through on it at all. And this is one that I think I laughed at it, you know, found something to laugh at in every scene.
I think it helps, too, that it has some emotional underpinning to it as well. There is a drama between these characters, not unlike Spinal Tap, where everyone has to kind of drift apart and drift back together. And I think that plays out really convincingly, as silly as this movie is, and as it, much as sort of the characters beg not to be taken seriously, I think you take them seriously enough to have a stake in their happiness.
I think it's really significant that the directors assume that their audience is not even going to have the patience in this film to sit through a full Lonely Island music video. All of the songs in this film are, and many of them are really, really funny, but they're all truncated. Like even Finest Girl, which I have touted on Twitter and listened to many, many times. You can find the full length uncensored video online, and you really need to watch the uncensored version. But even within the context of the film, when it plays hilariously, they only play about 2/3 of the song. They assume that your patience might be tried by like literally the length of a pop song. And that really speaks to how fast moving and how tight this movie is.
Well, and also like both the movie and the songs know to get in and get out before the joke gets too old. Like Lonely Island songs rarely go above 3 minutes. And I think it's notable that both Popstar and Spinal Tap get in and out in under 90 minutes. You know, like they don't stretch the joke too far. And that's really important, I think, when you're dealing with kind of quote-unquote stupid humor.
I've read and watched a lot of the interviews that The Lonely Island did around this movie, in part because of the hilarious thing they did with Jimmy Fallon.
Yeah.
They just stuck fake Jimmy Fallon quotes in like every TV interview that they did. But one of the things they consistently talk about is having watched a lot of comedy movies themselves and knowing how tedious they can get when you spend too much time on a joke. So they were so committed to, you know, not joke, but joke. And it's hard to recover from that kind of comedy. Like you feel like you're in the ring with a boxing master and you're just getting hit. And it amps the humor up so much. This movie was so unexpected for me. Like I was not sure like whether I was going to consistently love it. And it was one of those films where I couldn't close my mouth because I'd be laughing and then gaping and then laughing and then gaping.
I was thrilled that I enjoyed this movie as much as I did, because like I was in the can for this movie going in. Like I was on film spotting at their for their end of the year show last year, and we were talking about our predictions for in film for this year. And I brought up this film when it was still called Connor for Real, not Popstar. And it's something I was very excited for because I love The Lonely Island. I love their albums. But I was worried because their humor seemed like something that could become very stupid and not a good way when stretched out over feature film length. And I'm really happy that that is not the case here. Like, it is stupid, but in a very funny, laugh out loud way.
I think it helps also they give you a lot of different types of gags. There's a cornucopia of humor in here, whether it's a funny song or Seal showing up.
Yeah,
or
lots of unexpected, well, maybe not that unexpected, but celebrity appearances. Or incongruous celebrity experience.
Right.
Or, you know, did any of you see Zoolander 2? Am I the only one who saw it?
Because yes,
this is such a lesson in like how to have all of those celebrity cameos and make each one of them count. Whereas, you know, with Zoolander 2, it's like, where's the joke? You just have recognizable celebrities showing up, and there's no humor there at all. There's no why are they there?
It's actually really remarkable to me how much this movie resembles Zoolander 2 in all of the different kinds of things it's trying to do, and how much better it does all of them. I mean, you also have the rise and fall arc of the clueless, oblivious star who's having problems connecting with the people around him and needs to like build old relationships back up again. Like, all of these beats are the same beats. And I mean, in the end, one of the things that just comes down to for me is Ben Stiller's comedy is this comedy of broadness. It's so huge and blank and over the top. And I feel like he's just a giant charisma void at the middle of this film. Whereas
Zoolander 2.
What?
In the middle of Zoolander 2
specifically.
Yeah.
Whereas Andy Samberg is just, I feel like he's just so much more of a winning presence, even playing a character that's like meant to be equally large and broad and meant to draw audience disapproval, he's more charismatic. He's more in the character. He's more in the moment.
There's no meanness or cynicism to, like, even when he's playing a very stupid character, it comes across as like goofy and loving rather than mocking, I think.
I mean, the word silly is probably
silly,
the,
yeah. He's a goofball.
It's the defining word of this whole venture. I mean, if you talk about the difference, I guess, between Pop Star and This Is Spinal Tap, I think you could talk about This Is Spinal Tap as being, you know, a satire of the music business. And I don't think this is much more of a parody. This is much more of a almost airplane style. Let's just bombard the audience with jokes. We'll have jokes just coming from every possible corner, and hopefully the hit rate will be high enough to sustain the movie, which is a hard thing to do, but I think the movie achieves that.
But as you were saying, there's also so many different types of humor. You know, there is that, there's the parody of the music industry, there's like mocking this absurdist character, there's satire, there's banter, there's recognition parody, there's nostalgia parody. There's so many different angles that they hit this from, and that's one of the things that really keeps it moving. Whereas like Zoolander 2 kind of feels like
an effort here. I mean, I think really they are, you know, this is their shot to make a true Lonely Island movie, and this is a group that's been doing this for 15 years. I mean, I think you really feel the commitment to making it good, and that is not Zoolander 2. That commitment is not there, and it kills the movie. And it just, you know, and again, the way if you talk about the way celebrities are used is just so clever. I mean, Justin Timberlake, for example, as a guy who basically is their chef, who is very proud of the different ways he cuts carrots for them.
Julien.
He tries to sing, but is shut down. It's a very clever use of that character, and also a nice wink to his story and how it's, you know, reflected in the story of Connor for Real, or at least partially connected to the story for Connor for Real.
The As Themselves cameos are quite good too. Mariah Carey, oh, yeah, talking about how she relates to the song about how humble, you know, being so humble. Ringo Starr is in this movie.
Yeah. I loved Usher's excitement over doing the donkey roll. The donkey roll.
I love the donkey roll. I can see why it was a big hit.
And I like that they mentioned the donkey roll many times, but they hold off. You don't get to see the donkey roll like in full until that segment on Fallon.
The dance is so great, too.
It's so good.
Oh my gosh. So I wanted to ask you a question, Genevieve, because back in the day, I used to assign you to see films such as the Justin Bieber music documentary, and you would come back with informed reviews. So I was curious to ask you.
You mean you haven't caught up on them since then?
I have not. So I want to, I want to talk, how is the style, I guess, of Pop Star reflective of the style of this movie?
Yeah, it's, I mean, the whole idea of kind of a concert doc. I mean, obviously Spinal Tap has performance footage, but the kind of MTV strain of concert doc is very much, its energy is divided between kind of a You Are There concert experience and, you know, quote unquote, personal moments with the star. And there's lots of, you know, social media overlays. I know in the first Justin Bieber documentary, there's a lot of just like tweets popping up on screen and, you know, showing him interacting with his fans that way. And that's something that pop star does quite a bit. But it's more just the way that the concert footage is presented as a spectacle in and of itself that really brought that out. Plus, just Connor is a very Bieber-esque character in many ways.
Dumb.
Yes. Yes.
He's got a lot of tattoos. They basically have a lot of.
But yeah, I'm sure if Universal had allowed the budget, they would have made those concert scenes in 3D, because those movies always make the concert scenes in 3D and, you know, shoot lasers and bubbles at you, because that's kind of the idea of them, is like putting you in the front row.
Well, stagecraft wise, they're probably pretty similar too,
yeah.
Though.
Yeah, I mean, Justin Bieber does so many quick changes, the magic tricks.
Oh yeah, I'm just now remembering the scene of him with all of his changes.
I do appreciate that Popstar is an equal opportunity nudity delivery device.
I would say perhaps, you know, unequal in the opposite direction is what you
want. Yeah, probably.
Mostly
yeah.
Because the Sandberg spends a significant amount of time without clothing on, and like, I'm not sure many other people in the movie do.
Well, there's
the fan outside the limo.
There's that. That's
who's
very,
Judd Apatow, by the way?
That's very Walk Hard.
Well,
by
that's the rumor.
I thought that was confirmed. Why am I even talking about this?
That is a gag directly out of Walk Hard.
Yeah.
That's just, you know, here's the male genitals that are going to just sit on the screen for a long period.
Yeah, and I got to say that the Walk Hard is, I would give the advantage in this particular case, but
the window sliding down the little like friction that was a
that
nice touch.
Yeah.
So is the, like, he does gamely sign the penis that is presented to him for signature, you know, but he does so like by holding the pen by the tip as though getting like a pen's length distance will somehow make a difference, and like holding it up with Kleenex with that hilarious like Andy Samberg like wrinkled schnauzer face that he does. While we're talking about the style, I thought one of the things we should maybe address is the specific style of humor, both here and in Spinal Tap. I think there's a very specific strain of humor that runs through like the Lonely Islands projects in general, just as there's a very specific strain of humor that runs through Spinal Tap and like through it into the movies that Christopher Guest made in the mockumentary form. And I think it's really interesting sort of tracking their projects over time, how you can see like this very strong sensibility that lives in both groups of people that work together over and over and over. In the Lonely Islands case, there's the sense of like the over-the-top comedy that's based very strongly in undercutting and humiliating themselves. And like, I recently watched Hot Rod because I was wondering, is it as hilarious as Popstar? And just nobody's told me. And I really disliked that movie, but I did see in it that they are kind of trying to do some of the same thing in terms of creating kind of pompous characters who believe in themselves, even though they maybe shouldn't. And then if you look at Christopher Guest's movies, you see that same Spinal Tap sense of humor over and over. That's the very straight-faced people who take themselves very seriously and don't crack a smile as they're saying ridiculous things, and who have these like elaborate dialogues that are improvised that are built up into kind of bigger and bigger weirdness while always maintaining that sense of solemnity about them. I think it's interesting that you can see in both cases a very specific style of humor carried forward through all of these different projects.
Let's back up and say, I like Hot Rod.
Why?
It's uneven, but it makes me laugh. It's got the training montage. It's got Chris Parnell talking about AM radio. It's got talking about the future of AM radio. I don't know. I like it.
I mean, for me, it just kind of typified that idea of taking the one joke and running way, way, way too far with it and making it tedious. And for me, the big difference between Popstar and Hot Rod, apart from pacing, is that Popstar is about arrogant characters being ridiculous, whereas Hot Rod is so much about kind of pathetic, sad, small characters who it becomes very complicated with the sympathies, because you're not looking up at them and laughing at where they've put themselves. You're looking down at them and trying not to feel sorry for them.
But both of them have this absurdist element to them that I like. I mean, I think the big, I guess, virally scene from Hot Rod is that whole Cool Beans thing, which is just so stupid and silly and works, I think, pretty wonderfully in the film. And I think there's that willingness to, you know, throw the brakes on a movie if necessary, to just go for some absurd gag that the audience doesn't expect. And there's, I think there are examples in Popstar of that as well, where you're not really moving things forward, you're just kind of stopping to do something very strange, like have a bunch of wolves and Seal, and the wolves are agitated by Seal's voice, and he's got, that's a very strange thing to think of to do, it lends their work an unexpected absurdist charm.
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting things about that kind of that comparison in Christopher Guest style versus Lonely Island style is Lonely Island is all about fully and energetically committing to the bit, whereas Christopher Guest style, I mean, I know it's a Rob Reiner movie, but Christopher Guest picked up that style and ran with it for all the improv films he did. And the style there is so much about noodling in circles around the bit, like intellectually exploring it in really funny ways.
We could just do you remember this funny bit over and over again, but we haven't even talked about the brilliance of the TMZ parody with
Will. Oh, how do we
could not. For me, it's probably the funniest gags in the movie.
The ever-growing water bottle, sippy water bottles.
And just, it's just so, when Will Arnett's doing this thing where he's like this blustery, confident character who is barely hiding that he's falling apart inside. It's just the quintessential Will Arnett character, and it's so beautifully done in this movie.
Will Arnett was my favorite part of Hot Rod, I will say.
Okay.
That.
All right.
And it's such a plausible psychological profile for him, for all of those TMZ people who must be just, whose souls are just rotting.
Well, yeah, it's such a vicious parody of TMZ-style journalism and kind of the toxic smugness of it. And that's, I mean, that's what makes it. The visual gag of the ever-growing and multiplying, like, giant cups that they're all sipping out of is an example of that, like, Lonely Island, like, super absurdity. But, like, the whole piece in and of itself is just such a brutal takedown of that particular style of, like, sneery journalism. And it's really fun to watch.
Well, I am going to focus in a little bit on our topics. Keith, let's start with you. You wanted to talk about something that I spoke a little bit about in the keynote, but is kind of quintessential to both of these films' appeal, I think.
Yeah, I want to talk about the editing, which we did already cover. But let me start by telling you a story. I used to work at a video store in Madison, Wisconsin, called Four Star Video Heaven, which is still around. Shout out to Four Star Video Heaven. If you're in Madison, Wisconsin, it's a great place to rent a movie. But they used to have, this is back in the VHS era, and they used to get all these videos from a somewhat shady source called Video Search of Miami. They come in sort of these plain wrappers with the same font on it, and it would be like out of print movies, quasi-pornographic European stuff from the 70s. But one thing they had was the bootleg version of This Is Spinal Tap, the 4.5-hour version.
Ooh.
And I remember it's like on two videotapes. I'd take it home. It's like, this is it. This is like the uncut China White of This Is Spinal Tap. And I love This Is Spinal Tap. What could be better than 4.5 hours of it? And it is dull. I mean, here you will just, I mean, you think just watching these guys riff and improv or whatever is going to be, you're going to be laughing like you wouldn't believe, but it doesn't work. It makes you, I mean, Spinal Tap is 82 minutes long, and it is not a wasted minute in it. And it is, makes you appreciate what a job it was to cut it down from all those hours of footage. And, you know, the various DVDs have had deleted scenes on them, and they're fun to watch. I like watching them, and actually explain some things too. The cold sore bit throughout the film gets explained by them hooking up with a female band that they all sleep with, and they all catch you know.
Oh, I read that it was like a lip piercing thing that had gotten infected.
In one of those deleted scenes, they actually comment on the fact that, have you ever gotten one of these? And like the fact that in the live movie, there's a point where they all have cold sores. Like it's.
I like that it's just there. Like that.
Yeah. It's, I mean, it's good stuff. I mean, Bruno Kirby in his underwear singing Frank Sinatra songs. You get clips from Harry Shearer acting in an Italian, like a giallo thriller or whatever. But it doesn't, none of it would improve the film, which is perfect as it is. And like, even down to where they cut, we talked about this in Lonely Island a little bit, but where they cut in the film itself. Like, I think it's funny that Give Me Some Money gets cut off mid drum fill. I mean, just that edit makes me laugh. The way the Listen to the Flower People gets cut off like mid guitar solo. It's just you don't overstay your welcome. It's just beautifully done. It is makes me appreciate that. And I was thinking about that in relation to Popstar, which I can't imagine. It doesn't seem to me to be as improv, or certainly, well, a few things are as improv as this is Spinal Tap,
right.
But just the amount of set building and the various locations they had to go to. But it is tight, especially for a Judd Apatow executive produced movie. It's a tight film. I imagine the editing process happens earlier when they, because there's such a, as I said before, there's such a multitude of types of gags and gags upon gags upon gags. I imagine that instead of hours of footage, there's probably pages of virtual pages of discarded drafts of funny material here. But I mean, to me, though, both of them are the products of people that know how to be economical with what they're doing. And I think that's an underappreciated art.
Oh, absolutely. One of my, probably my favorite Christopher Guest movies is A Mighty Wind, which is a satire of folk music industry. And there is a scene in that where Bob Balaban is haranguing Michael Hitchcock about stagecraft, about the fact that they're it's right before the big show, and he's standing on stage saying, you know, I can, why are there lights hanging there? That doesn't seem safe. And Michael Hitchcock gets more and more agitated. And finally, Bob Balaban is like, I can see a wire. And Hitchcock just reaches over and paps him on the top of the head, dope slaps him, basically. And the scene cuts instantly. And if you listen to the commentary, they say that that is because the entire crew burst out laughing. It was an improv moment. Nobody knew he was going to do it. He didn't know he was going to do it. And they literally cut at the last usable frame before everybody chorused. And when I was watching Spinal Tap, one of the things I was noticing was there are a lot of edits that come like that. Right after You Can't Dust for Vomit, right after... This goes to 11 the second time. There's this, that instantaneous cut. And it both speaks to, we know when to get out of a bit. And we know like that it's going to make you laugh in and of itself that scene ends in that split second. But it also kind of makes me want to believe that like the next frame is just everybody bursting into hysterics.
And it most likely is. Mm-hmm. I mean, how can you not? I mean, like you said, the You Can't Dust for Vomit made me laugh just now.
It makes me laugh when you say it.
Well, the fact they don't break, though, is like it was somebody else's vomit. That to me, I would probably lose it there. But.
That is actually, I mean, that also is just one of my favorite Spinal Tap scenes, because it, more than anything else in the entire movie, that feels like they're coming up with it in the moment. And Michael McKean's face especially, you can feel him kind of like fighting down the urge to either giggle or congratulate people, like congratulate Guest especially on his improv.
We don't know as much about the process of Popstar, and I think it's probably safe to assume, as Keith does, that it is more planned out and more written, but that the discipline is there. And you know, you talked about it earlier about knowing how far to go into one of the songs before saying that's enough. You know, just you have to be concise, and you have to know when something is going to be funny and when it's going to stop being funny and cut maybe a beat before, you know, just having a sense of the overall pace of the thing. And Popstar to me is almost particularly perilous in that regard, because it feels so random. A lot of the jokes do kind of come out of the blue, and a lot of that can just feel like fat you want to cut away. And the film does impose a certain amount of discipline on that process, and you can feel it, and it makes the film tighter and funnier.
It is interesting how the editing changes towards the end of Popstar as you get into the business with with them like approaching their old bandmate out on the farm. That was the point where I started getting worried that the film was going to kind of descend into bathos, because it slows down, the jokes stop coming as quickly, you start like dealing with authentic emotions. But like even that is, as you say, it's pretty economical. It's mm-hmm. here is what the plot requires. We're going to get in and out as quickly as possible without losing the moment, without making the moment so quick that it becomes insincere. Like that in and of itself is a really difficult balancing act, and it's one that Judd Apatow films in particular I think have trouble with.
Yeah.
So I was pretty impressed with that.
Talking about that sequence at the farm and what follows that kind of segues nicely into your topic, which is something these two movies share, which is the comeback arc.
I just thought it was an interesting thing that both of these films are essentially about people who start in theory as huge success stories at the top of their game and then are undercut very sharply. I mean, it's kind of a Behind the Music story. It's about how people who have built up a certain amount of arrogance because they believe they're at the top of the world are laid low enough that we can sympathize with them, or laid low enough that they become accessible. And we laugh at them. We laugh at their humiliation because they're arrogant, but we also laugh at, you know, their flailing, at their suffering, honestly. I mean, one of the funniest moments in Popstar for me is when Connor Farrell is looking at his negative 4 out of 10 Pitchfork review and the fact that Rolling Stone gave him a poop emoji out of 4 stars. These characters, what makes them funny is that they're so arrogant and they're so sure of themselves. What makes them human is that they fail. And then what makes the story fun is they get to kind of pick it up back at the end. And it's interesting to me that with Spinal Tap, the comeback at the end it's just a fait accompli. It's just kind of and by the way, we're really successful someplace else. So it's almost tacked onto the end to give you an up arc, but it's still there to make this comedy a happy story instead of a tragic one. With Popstar, it's much more of a big, roaring, joyous pop comeback. But in both cases, you have this movie that follows the exact same roller coaster arc throughout to very similar purposes, I think.
Yeah, both end up hailing the virtues of teamwork and mm-hmm. friendship, and how the whole is more than the sum of the parts. Or is that right?
Sure.
Yeah. How the whole's the sum of its parts. That Connor should not be writing his own songs, for example, and
making his own beats
or stealing other people's work.
Yeah,
no, he shouldn't be doing any of those things.
Both films are also about the fickleness of fame, you know, not the fickleness of the fans necessarily, but just the fact that you cannot rely on fame, and fame to some degree feeds on itself, but you still can't rely on it.
I think it's interesting to note that like Spinal Tap were friends from childhood and the Style Boys were friends from childhood. you know, Popstar has that bit about all the different people Connor has on his payroll, and he has the one guy to, you know, kick him in the nuts to keep him humble or whatever. But you know, with the way both of these, you know, stories kind of resolve, there is sort of an idea of like going back to your roots or going back to, you know, the thing that made you, more so with Popstar than with Spinal Tap.
Yeah, I mean, I think in music stories particularly, there's a certain feeling that authenticity is everything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we can also go back to LA Confidential and the whole cut versus uncut thing on that. But I mean, both of these films are about characters that have become, in a way, you know, phony and caught up in the fame.
You have to remember that it's about the music, man. And with that awesome segue,
going
to bring up my topic, which is Music Man.
Wait, we're talking about the Music Man?
We're talking about, no.
I haven't seen that film in years. I'm not prepared for this.
76 trombones.
All right. Besides the mockumentary format, the strongest link between Popstar and Spinal Tap is the way the two films use original comedic music throughout. But where the music of Spinal Tap, the fictional band, was first introduced to the world via the film, The Lonely Island had an established musical persona going into Popstar. At this point, Spinal Tap songs like Tonight I'm Gonna Rock You Tonight and Big Bottom are almost as well known as the film that spawned them. By 1984, they served as the debut, such as it is, of England's loudest band, and are part of the foundation of the band's mythology. By contrast, The Lonely Island has been well known for its song parodies since at least Lazy Sunday debuted on SNL in 2005, and they released 3 full-length albums prior to Popstar. The humor, tone, and production value of the music and pop stars heavily informed what The Lonely Island has produced before, perhaps most notably in the climactic guest appearance by Michael Bolton, who performed on one of the trio's biggest hits, Jack Sparrow. So I guess what I'm trying to get at here is that where the music in This Is Spinal Tap feels like an extension of the film, Popstar feels more like an extension of The Lonely Island's music. Does that ring true to you guys at all, or should we just spend the segment kind of naming our favorite songs from the films? Because I'm cool with that, too.
Can we do both?
Yeah.
I mean, no, I think you're right. I think that this is very much an extension of maybe not where they started musically with Lazy Sunday, or where they became huge viral hits with Lazy Sunday, but where they've ended up with Jack Sparrow and YOLO and I Just Had Sex and I'm on a Boat, like all of these big chest thumping rap anthems that are about like conspicuous consumption and outsized lifestyle and all of the things that so much rap is about. They've just kind of extended that into the characters themselves, and it works really well.
Also, much like Spinal Tap, it works because it's so convincing. I mean, these are really catchy songs. They're absurd. They're all, especially Akiva Schaffer, really great rappers. You know,
yeah,
it's,
really.
It's I don't think it would work if it was just goofy people with no flow. I mean, they know what they're doing and they do it very well. Just on the basic level, the free associative allusions and references are all, it's just really fun to hear it.
Yeah, I think The Lonely Island are really talented musicians. I mean, we talked in the first half about the actors who play Spinal Tap, like, you know, having some real musical chops. And that is certainly the case here, too. Like, the production on these songs, for the most part, is indistinguishable from a lot of what's sure. on pop radio. And, you know, their lyrics are silly and stupid and occasionally don't rhyme, but they're also, like, really smart about language mm-hmm. in some ways. Like, I brought this up on Twitter to Scott, but the song I'm So Humble, which I actually like more than Finest Girl, but, like, the opening lines of that are, bar none, I am the most humblest, number one at the top of the humble list. And that is just such brilliant, terrible wordplay that, like, it blows my mind every time I hear it. Like, I love that line. And they have a lot of little just turns of phrase like that that are, they're great.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, that reminds me, too, of A Big Bottom. And one of the things I like about that song is that there are two different occasions where they rhyme day with day.
Yeah.
which is, this, you know, again, really clever, bad songwriting. But I think one of the things that I've always really liked about Lonely Island is the fact that they have these very silly, ridiculous, self-deprecating lyrics, but in order to bring those lyrics across, they really do have to go hard. You mm-hmm. know, I mean, like, in they're convinced that, you know, they're vocally and musically tremendously convincing, you know, and it also makes the songs, you know, easy to listen to mm-hmm. more than once.
And they pick their collaborators well.
They do. They do have that Pitbull-ish quality from finding collaborators. See, I can make reference to Pitbull.
You can make lots of references if we talk about your topic next.
Oh, my gosh. How about that?
My segue, my beautiful segue.
I'm sorry. I am busting your flow.
All right.
But I have to say, like, so much, you're talking about them extending their music. So much of their music is about that dynamic of big chest beating braggadocio and undercutting themselves. And again, that plays out through the characters and everything they do with the characters in the story, but it also just, it plays out in the songs here. I mean, Jack Sparrow is one of my favorite all-time things, and it's all about the back and forth conflict between chest thumping rap and something ridiculous and undercutting. And, like, I'm So Humble works for you. I'm still stuck on the Bin Laden song, which
it's good. I like it a lot.
But specifically includes, you know, it's about having hot sex with a freak, but it undercuts it with lines like, I couldn't track the metaphor and I still don't see the appeal, but he went ahead and had sex and it was great. But he's still got to take it back. And they do the same thing in I Just Had Sex. I think she was a racist. It still counts. So that's just a dynamic I see in their music over and over and over. And for me, it still hasn't gotten old.
Yeah.
Because so much of the culture is about, like, that big, oversized, you know, penis waving, basically. And
or just penis dragging along a window.
Slowly dragging up a window before signing it. So you had some sort of segue in mind.
Yeah, now that you've totally trashed my segue, Scott, talk about pop culture.
Segue. Pop culture, colon. So.
Wow, I have just really undercut your chest thumping segue here.
No, okay. That's all right. In true Lonely Island fashion. See, that's pretty good, right?
Yeah.
That's bringing it in for a landing. So one of the things that fascinates me about movies like Popstar is what they tell us now and down the road about what the music scene was like at a particular time. We saw that a little bit in This Is Spinal Tap, which references a specific strain of pop pomposity, but also the structure of the business at the time, the label parties, the venues, the store signings, the record release and touring strategies, etc. I often think about the movie Josie and the Pussycats, which I think we admire, which is now 15 years old, by the way, and how much MTV's Times Square location was the epicenter for pop music at that time, with Total Request Live and Carson Daly being, you know, the primary engine for pop success. And that model now is just completely obliterated. And we have Popstar, a movie that exists because The Lonely Island took off on SNL and YouTube as a viral phenomenon that nobody had to pay to see or hear, which may explain why the film failed at the box office. That was an interesting theory that someone brought up, like, we've seen the Lonely Island videos for free. Why am I going to pay to see them in a movie? I don't know. Anyway, but watching the film too, I think we get a sense of how pop phenomena happens in 2016, how buzz can build around someone and fade just as quickly, how childhood nostalgia can bring back long defunct bands like the Style Boys from the Dead, and how specific tools of self-promotion that are exploited by musicians now, like, you know, and the narcissism that goes along with that. You know, you often hear pop stars talking about using social media to, quote unquote, you know, speak directly to fans, but they roar themselves at the same time. In the movie, pop star sort of makes fun of that strain of pop star vanity that wouldn't have been possible, you know, 5 or 10 or even like 5 years
ago. They want to bring on an opening act.
What?
We have an opening act. Owen DJs.
Hey, I'm always saying Style Boys could be the opener.
No, man. Will you stop with that?
Dude, people keep blowing up my Twitter about us doing Donkey Roll.
Oh, they're blowing up your Twitter?
Yeah.
How many followers do you have, Owen?
Like 500,000.
Okay, well, I got 20 million and no one's asking me to do that.
Man, some of those are probably bots.
Yeah, there's a lot of really specific to 2016 or thereabouts in this movie. And I think this movie will age well, but it will always be an artifact of
which is great.
There's absolutely nothing wrong with it.
That's a feature.
But I, you know, talking about specifics, I love the line of watch for the new single. We're surprise releasing it next Thursday at 4. And the whole thing with Jimmy Fallon and like them like surprise reuniting on the Tonight Show to do the Donkey Roll, because like that is what Jimmy Fallon does. Like he brings the Saved by the Bell cast on. You know, like it's just so spot on. And it's something that was obviously facilitated by the relationship these guys have with Jimmy Fallon. And
it's another also Fallon like choosing to participate, like him specifically engineering that so that he can do the Donkey Roll with those guys.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is something Usher fantasizes about but can't have. It's such a Fallon thing.
Another detail I really liked in the movie was the parody of the U2 album that all of us owned without wanting to. So in Popstar, he releases his record through an appliance company. So every time you use your refrigerator, your toaster, you've got songs from the new Connor for Real album, which I thought was great. And really, the reaction is not that more extreme in Popstar than it was in real life to U2. People really, really hated having a free U2 album.
I never got that, but that's a whole different. That's a whole different conversation.
Well, plus you get the great visual gag of his album release being them like opening a refrigerator and a stove, and the music coming out, or like that being his big premiere.
I liked Maya Rudolph was way up there on the list of good cameos.
And then at the end, Deborah, why is she here?
I also really like Joan Cusack. I was kind of if there are deleted scenes out there, I would hope there's some more of Joan Cusack as Connor's deeply irresponsible mother.
Yeah, there's a lot of Blink and You'll Miss Him cameos, like Will Forte popping up playing bagpipes at his turtle's funeral. Like, he didn't even have a line. It was literally a 2-second shot of Will Forte playing the bagpipes, you know.
I didn't recognize Weird Al either.
I did.
That was a nice little nod.
Like you have to give a tip of the hat to Weird Al if you're a music parodist.
When we're talking about all of the stars that show up and get name checked during this, though, I have to ask: does it make anybody else a little uncomfortable that these are a bunch of white rappers and like most of the people they bring on to talk about how inspirational and important this fake band was are famous black rappers.
Oh, I think that's entirely intentional.
Oh, of course it's intentional. Yeah. It still made me uncomfortable.
Oh, it didn't make me uncomfortable.
It tracks also, if these are kind of Beastie Boys surrogates in a way, these people would show up for the Beastie Boys.
Would they? Questlove?
Oh, yeah. Beastie Boys?
Questlove, yeah.
Everyone
yeah.
loves Questlove. The Beastie Boys.
Yeah. The fact that, like, you have hip-hop legends, you know, commenting on this, like, heightens the absurdity of them loving this terrible white boy rap group, like, to the extent where it is a joke. Like, it's not like you have T-Pain on there or something, you know, extolling the virtues of the Style Boys. You have Nas and you have the Wu-Tang Clan,
and
you know.
50 Cent. Yeah. I mean, like, that is very specifically about a specific kind of legitimacy.
Yeah.
Well, and also, again, it gets to this question, this business of nostalgia too. I mean, maybe Style Boys were not respected at all at the time, but when you get far enough down the road, you know, it gets associated with people's childhoods, and suddenly this crappy thing that was disrespected at the time becomes a classic.
I just think the racial dynamics in this movie are interesting because you've got so much of the plot arc around Chris Redd as Hunter the Hungry kind of coming in and picking up the authenticity and the fandom that Connor for Real is rapidly shedding. I mean, one of the things we haven't really touched on in terms of like the pop culture and how this film fits into the now is Connor's social media presence and how much he overshares and how much he lives for instant feedback and his fame and his infamy online. But then you have this other like young up-and-comer that's clearly becoming more popular than him. And so much of that feels like it's about authenticity and the approval of Tim Meadows, which that in and of itself also becomes a really interesting dynamic. This is the first film I've seen in a while that passes the DuVernay test, that has two black characters talking to each other about something that has nothing to do with a white person. And that moment for me, I thought that was a really interesting moment where those two characters are allowed to have their own story and are allowed to be like their own thing that has nothing to do with like the central thrust of this film.
This isn't addressed the racial component of the film, but it does. One significant contrast between Hunter and Connor is the difference between, you know, an upcoming artist who is connected with, you know, what is real and what is happening now, and an artist, Connor, who is completely isolated and, you know, in his bubble of 23 personal assistants and in social media. And I mean, the film is very clever about parroting a very specific type of 21st century pop insularity, I guess, in the way he lives and the people that he has around him and all this affirmation that he gets from his fans, the affirmation that he gets from the people he pays to be his yes men. You know, there's a lot of good jokes that come out of that, but it's also what triggers his fall too, because he doesn't look at himself critically and connect with what it is that people find exciting and new and dynamic and that's really gonna have, you know, a resonance with listeners. He's just way too much in his own bubble.
And then he finds that resonance with listeners with a song that is essentially Insane Clown Posse's Miracles. I mean, can we just talk about how incredibly bat poop bizarre that song is?
Incredible Thoughts.
Yes, Incredible Thoughts. It really is Miracles. I mean, all that's missing is praise for magnets.
Oh, praise magnets. All right.
How do they work?
Well, I think that's as good a place to leave it as any. This is Spinal Tap is widely available on DVD and Blu-ray in a variety of special editions and apparently some weird Chinese bootleg VHS that's 4.5 hours long. Popstar is currently in theaters, but based on its lukewarm theatrical performance thus far, is more likely to find its cult audience when it's released on home video down the road. We'll be right back with our usual recommendation segment, Your Next Picture Show. Finally, it's time to catch each other up on films or film-related items we've seen in the interim since our last podcast. We call it Your Next Picture Show, in the hopes that it'll put some interesting choices on your radar. Keith, you want to kick us off?
I'll start off with a movie which I didn't know anything about, and I watched it. It's like, I'm still not quite sure what kind of movie I just watched, but it's quite good. It's a film called The Fits. It's the first narrative feature by a director named Anna Rose Holmer, and it was filmed in Cincinnati. It follows a kind of tomboy named Tony, who's 11 years old, trained to be a boxer, who kind of changes her mind or wants to try out for a dance troupe, and she's an outsider. There's virtually no dialogue, and especially from the lead character in the first stretch of this film, and kind of this nice portrait of pre-adolescent isolation. And then it kind of takes a turn as the various girls in her troupe kind of fall prey to this mysterious ailment that causes them to cause seizures. And it feels like it's turning into a horror movie, and not to spoil anything, it doesn't turn into a horror movie. It kind of loops back around to being what it always was, but in a really interesting and oblique and mysterious way. And it's beautifully shot, quite stylishly shot, with a great lead performance from my favorite, well, certainly my favorite child actor of the year, but also my favorite actor name of the year, which is Royalty Hightower. that is the name of a future star. So it's kind of slowly rolling out, but very much worth seeking out. And it won't take up much of your time either. It's about, I think, 72 minutes long, or mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a short feature, but it's a full meal. I like it.
Yeah, agreed. Co-signed. I wrote about that one for The Verge, and it was, for me, it's very much like a dance piece, because so much of the movie is about her physicality, both in training and in dancing and in practicing alone, but also just where she stands in proximity to other people, you know, whether she makes herself part of a group or stands outside it, how groups change when she approaches them, how she physically interacts with boys, with girls, with different kind of people. There's so much about physicality in this movie, and it's so refreshing. I'm with you on kind of having that feel of, I'm not entirely sure what kind of movie I just watched, but it's such a good feeling, you know? It's such a good feeling to see something that not only doesn't slot into any really like neat little holes, but kind of gives you like a refreshing look on film, really, on the kind of stories the film can tell.
Scott, you got a recommendation for us?
I do. I wanted to recommend a film called De Palma. I bow to no one in my love of Brian De Palma, so I was already in the bag for Noah Baumbach and Jake Paltrow's documentary about him, if only because De Palma could always use some more fans / apologists, and this is a chance to make the case for him on a large scale. I will confess, however, to be mildly disappointed that De Palma is as conventional a film as its subjects' films are not. This is basically a solid DVD extra with De Palma as the only talking head running through each of his films one by one. That said, De Palma himself tells some very funny stories, and the film is just loaded with fantastic insight about what it was like to be an artist in the Hollywood of the 70s and the Hollywood of the 21st century, about the eye of the director and what the role of a good director is, and also about how art passes through the culture. I left the film wanting to write at least 3 or 4 separate essays about it. So it's something to talk about. I mean, really stuff like how special effects, people who do special effects in movies and how you hand movies over to them really come up with all these visual cliches that take it away from the director and make generic bad art. I thought that part of it was absolutely fascinating. So De Palma is, it should be rolling out pretty good. It thrills me that it is getting any kind of theatrical release at all, and A24 is putting it out. And I think if you're a De Palma fan, especially, you should, it's essential viewing.
Yeah, I think if you're a fan already, you know, just walking through film by film with De Palma as your guide is a treat, and some of the stories are fantastic. I particularly enjoyed the story of how Sean Penn would get Michael J. Fox riled up on the set of Casualties of War, in which they played antagonists, and kind of one scene where his character is required to whisper insults to the other, he whispers the word TV actor to him, which, yeah, it's a good one.
What about you, Genevieve?
Well, I caught up with a film from last year that kind of I always meant to catch up with, and now that it is on Netflix streaming, it was easy to do so. And that is the 2015 Sundance darling Dope, directed by Rick Famuyiwa. I'm probably butchering that. I'm sorry. I feel like when this movie came out and it was, you know, everyone was kind of buzzing about it, all I really processed about it is that it was about a group of 90s obsessed nerds living in present day Inglewood. And I just kind of assumed it was a sort of fish out of water coming of age story. So when I finally watched it, I was not prepared for what it actually is, which is a fish out of water drug caper story. This movie is actually kind of packed with incident, and it moves really well through its narrative with a lot of flair and not nearly as much like 90s kid pandering as I was expecting based on the reviews I'd read. Fumi Yue's direction is really dynamic, occasionally bordering on a little self-consciously flashy, but it's a really engaging film to watch, and the three lead actors are really great. I guess Fumi Yue was just announced as the director of the upcoming movie about The Flash, and based on the kind of kineticism he showed in Dope, I feel that feels like a really inspired match to me. So I guess I'm belatedly excited about Dope and prematurely excited about The Flash.
Oh yeah, Fumi Yue was also just directed Confirmation, which was the HBO movie. Did anybody besides me see that?
Oh, I thought no one liked that one though, right? It's the Anita Hill thing, right?
Yeah, it's the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas thing. I was going to say I liked it seems too strong, but no, I did like it. Okay. I think that it does some really interesting. I wrote about it for The Verge, so again, I don't really need to go into it in huge detail. You can find all that online, but it made me really interested in him as a director because it is so smart and careful about where it draws the line between the two characters and how it tells the story. And it really made me want to like loop back and see more of his stuff. And when I found out that it's all available on Netflix, that was a huge bonus that I have not exploited properly. So now I will have to. Thank you.
All right. So Tasha, bring us home. What do you got for us?
I've got a little movie called Twilight.
What?
I'm going to recommend to everybody because it's so good. This is the 1998 Twilight, directed by Robert Benton. After our Nice Guys LA Confidential pairing, my husband and I went on like a little sub LA noir tear, and we finally watched Night Moves, okay, for instance, which was really, really good. But one of the other things we watched was Twilight, which is much like Night Moves. It has Gene Hackman in it. It feels very aware of Night Moves in a lot of ways. It follows some of the same parallels. It's another LA noir movie. It's another kind of like rambling detective story about somebody trying to crack a case. Everybody is in this movie. It stars Paul Newman, Susan Sarandon, Gene Hackman, Reese Witherspoon, Stockard Channing, James Gardner, Juan Carlos Esposito, Liv Schreiber, Marco Martindale, Emmett Walsh, Jason Clarke. It's one of those movies where practically every small role that turns up on screen is a, oh my gosh, it's that person moment. And people turn up in really, really interesting and fun characters. It's very low key. Paul Newman plays a sort of detective who is definitely in the waning years of his life. And it's a slow roll kind of mystery story that is not in any particular hurry to get there. It has kind of that Elmore Leonard-y feel of very, very colorful characters doing very, very low level criminal stuff that they're not always physically or emotionally equipped for. And I don't want to say anything more about the plot because it's an unrequited love story. It's a requited love story. It's a murder mystery. And it's more LA noir. And it's a really surprising film in a lot of ways. Co-written and directed by Robert Benton, who also did Kramer versus Kramer and Still of the Night, Places in the Heart, more unfortunately, The Human Stain.
Well, I mean, if I recall, I mean, it was more touted as a follow-up to Benton and Newman's Nobody's Fool, right?
I was not aware of that, but
yeah, that was based on
a Richard Russo book, and this is co-written by Richard Russo. Yeah, Twilight's great. I'm one reason that I didn't see the more recent Twilight movie, so I don't have really an opinion about it one way or the other. Beyond it being kind of mad that it erased the title of a really good movie that not enough people have seen.
Although, I mean, Twilight as a title is generic enough that for me, it's just good for a laugh.
I appreciated that.
Apparently, a bunch of people in my letterbox got a notification that I had rated a movie called Twilight and were horrified until they found out what it was. But yeah, Twilight. Who knew?
All right. How can people see it? Is it?
We watched it on DVD, but I mean, it's on all of the usual pay-to-rent services, Amazon, Vudu, iTunes, YouTube, Google Play, pretty much all of the basics. It's pretty available. It's pretty out there.
All right. Well, next time I get the urge to watch Twilight again, maybe I'll watch that one instead.
I have seen the Catherine Hardwicke Twilight. You'd be doing yourself a favor with the Paul Newman Twilight.
All right. I'll keep that in mind. And that's another episode of The Next Picture Show in the books. Our next episodes come out June 28th and 30th, and our next pairing is a little out there, but hear us out. In 2003, the success of Pixar Animation's Finding Nemo gave director Andrew Stanton the freedom to make daring, experimental storytelling choices with Pixar's WALL-E, and to try his hand at epic fantasy blockbuster action with his live-action debut, John Carter. Here at the Next Picture Show podcast, we have a lot of appreciation for John Carter, which we covered in episodes 13 and 14, but it was a notorious commercial flop. That may explain why Stanton has migrated back to the headwaters of his birthplace with Finding Dory, a Finding Nemo sequel. You may remember the memory-impaired sidekick Dory, a blue tang voiced by Ellen DeGeneres. In Finding Dory, her childhood starts coming back to her. She realizes she's lost her family, and she goes on a quest to find them. That quest is a lot like the one at the center of Finding Nemo. It's also remarkably similar to the quest Guy Pearce's protagonist Leonard undergoes in another film about mystery and memory. Christopher Nolan's breakout Memento, about a man working to find his wife's murderer even though he suffers from a crippling form of memory impairment. Memento and Finding Dory are two very different films. One animated, one live action, one kid accessible, one adults only. But they're both about coping with loss and a handicap, about unfolding a mystery through discovery, and about the nature of memory and how it defines our identities. We'll be delving into all sorts of ways to compare Guy Pearce and a little blue animated fish in the next episodes. In the meantime, we'd love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of This is Spinal Tap, Popstar, and anything else film-related. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. Finally, before closing out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days? Keith?
You can find me at uprocks.com, where I'm editorial director of film and television, and on Twitter at kfips3000. As also on the most recent episode of a podcast called Alcohollywood, talking about John Carpenter's In the Mouth of Madness, which is a late Carpenter favorite of mine. So it's a pleasure to talk about it.
Scott?
You can find me on Twitter at @Scott_Tobias, and you can find my work at NPR, Variety, New York Times, Washington Post, Rolling Stone, Vulture, and Oscilloscope's Musings. I should also say that I was a talking head in the Viceland, Vice Guide to Film, Coen Brothers episode. So maybe you can seek that out as well.
You overshadowed George Clooney, I understand.
Yeah,
charisma just burned right through the screen.
I think so. I think I probably have more screen time than George Clooney, which is kind of weird. I would say counterintuitive would be the word I would use for that. I think they cut together my best stuff, so I'd encourage people to check it out.
Yeah, definitely seek that out. And Tasha?
I'm the film critic over at TheVerge.com. You can find my writing there. You can find me on Twitter at Tasha Robinson. And I was on the most recent episode of Cut Print Films Newsreel podcast talking about a piece I wrote for Verge about whether the word unfilmable still means anything anymore in relationship to books and movies.
And I'm on Twitter at Genevieve Kosky, and I was on the most recent episode of this podcast. You can stay updated on The Next Picture Show via Twitter at Next Picture Pod, via Facebook at facebook.com/Next Picture Show, or by visiting nextpictureshow.net. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to the show on iTunes. And while you're there, think about rating and reviewing us. Every thumbs up helps us find new listeners and keep the show going. Thanks to Colin, the Animal Griffith, for his assistance producing the show. And thanks to Delmark Records for providing recording space at their home base, Riverside Studios. The Next Picture Show is proud to be a part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts and the Panoply Network. Please tune in next time.
Incredible thoughts, incredible mind. I'm so overwhelmed. How did my brain conceive them?
A snow white dove in the pitch black night. Yeah. A raindrop falls from tremendous heights. A wave crashes off of a cliff in Scotland. A child bites an apple, but the core is rotten. TV is free, but what is the cost? We have GPS, and yet we're still lost. What if
if a garbage man was actually smart. A common misconception that we're tearing apart. And to a dog, dog food is just food. And to a sock, a mansion's just a big shoe. A milk dud sitting in the acid rain. A house cat addicted to the cocaine. No teeth, unlimited floss. These are just a few of our incredible thoughts.